Hej och välkomna tillbaka till Avanza-podden. Det är episod 330 och när det här spelas in så är det måndagen den 12 februari. Idag har vi äran att gästas av fondförvaltaren Cathy Wood som är förvaltare över vår fond Avanza Disruptive Innovation by ARK Invest. Och för mer information om själva fonden så kan ni kolla på avanza.se/avanza-by-ARK. För er som känner till Cathy så är hon ju då känd för att hon är vd för kapitalförvaltningsbolaget ARK Invest som håller på med disruptiv innovation. Och det kommer vi få höra allt om idag. Jag ska också bara informera om att Cathy är ju amerikan och det här avsnittet kommer att hållas på engelska av den anledningen. Och innan vi kör igång på riktigt så vill jag bara påminna om riskerna. Tänk på att det kan svänga. Historiskt har det varit lönsamt att investera i fonder, aktier och andra värdepapper. Men hur det går i framtiden, det är det ju ingen som vet. Så ha med det. Men nu tycker jag att vi bjuder in Cathy i samtalet. We are delighted to have you as a guest here in Avanza-podden once again, Cathy Wood. Warm welcome.
Thank you, Felicia. Very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting us to do this podcast.
Of course. And you have made a guest appearance once before. It was about a year ago when we launched a collaboration together with ARK Invest. And I'm just going to tell all the listeners that would be interested in that episode. It's episode 286. But I'm thinking that we will dive straight into it. Right, Cathy?
Absolutely.
So the fund that you have with us is Avanza Disruptive Innovation by ARK Invest. Can you tell us a bit about disruptive innovation? What is it and what does it mean for ARK Invest?
Yes, so disruptive innovation in our world is technologically enabled. And there are five major innovation platforms evolving today that involve 14 different technologies that we believe will transform the world and make it a better place. Those five platforms are robotics, energy storage, artificial intelligence, blockchain technology, and multi-omic sequencing in the life sciences space. And what we mean by disruptive innovation, there are three characteristics that we believe these platforms have. One is that they are riding down learning curves, which are expressed in cost declines that are passed through as price declines, so deflationary. Two is that they are cutting across economic sectors, and we believe they'll become mass market opportunities. And three is they will become launching pads for more innovation. So the five innovation platforms we're seeing today, really, we've never seen five before. The last time we saw anything like this was in the early 1900s, telephone, electricity, and the internal combustion engine. So those were three platforms. We now have five. And the rate of growth that we think these will deliver will dwarf what we saw in the early 1900s.
So what you see in disruptive innovation today can be somehow in comparison to the boom in 2000, the internet boom?
Yes. No. The boom, we think this boom is more like the roaring 20s of the early 1900s. The late 90s, interestingly, it's a good example of technology not being ready and costing too much. The seeds for the five innovation platforms around which we have centered our research and our investing, the seeds were planted back then in the 20 years that ended in the tech and telecom bubble. And those seeds have been germinating for 20, 30 years. Now they're ready for prime time.
Now they're ready for prime time. But we can also see, because the fund that you have with us, it's been with us for more than a year now, and you have made a return on more than 20% in the fund. That's not a bad result at all. Congratulations, I must say.
Oh, Yes, well, thank you. It is a couple of things are happening now and have happened in the last year. The market began to expect that interest rates were topping out. And actually in the fourth quarter, as some inflation metrics surprised on the low side of expectations, the bond market began to expect 5 to 6 interest rate cuts in 2024. And it's equivocating now as numbers come out, and it seems like some sectors of the economy are stronger than expected. But we believe that in this next year, inflation is going to surprise on the low side of expectations, and in fact could be negative, in large part because of the disruptive innovation associated with these technologies.
Can you please develop that? What do you mean that it will be a deflation due to disruptive innovation?
Well, the Fed is aiming for 2% inflation. And if you look at the CPI and other inflation measures, they are close to 3%. The CPI was as high as 9% in June of 2022. And now it's down to close to 3%. We think it's going to drop not only to 2%, but could fall below 2% and enter negative territory on a year-over-year basis in the next year. And there are a number of reasons. Disruptive innovation that's technologically enabled is deflationary. Costs come down over time, prices come down. So that's one. The second is the other side of the bottlenecks, the supply chain bottlenecks that really caused inflation to boom in 21 and 22. We think we're on the other side of that, and that many industries ordered too much. They double ordered, triple ordered, quadruple ordered because they couldn't get supply. Now they're stuck with too much inventory. And to clear that inventory, we believe they'll have to cut prices. And then the other reason that prices might fall is if we're right on disruptive innovation, then the other side of that is creative destruction. And what that means is these new technologies are going to take the place of technologies from the past. A good example of this is the internal combustion engine. We believe that the internal combustion engine is going to die in the next 5 to 10 years. And in order to clear the cars from dealer lots around the world, prices will have to come down for those gas-powered vehicles. So those are the three reasons we expect deflation, really not only in this next year, but it could continue in the years ahead.
Okay, thank you for that involvement. But if we go back to this past year, has anything happened during the year that's really surprised you within economics or politics, the stock market?
Yes, I think there have been a couple of surprises. It looks like in the U.S. at least, real economic activity has been okay if you look at the GDP statistics. You know, we haven't dropped into a recession. We believe we've been in somewhat of a rolling recession in the last few years. Housing by some measures is down 20 to 40%. Auto manufacturing is still near recessionary levels. Commercial real estate is having significant problems in when it comes to office space, but even multifamily dwellings. And inventories are still too high, so they still have to come down. We've been surprised that the GDP statistics have looked so good, but there is another metric out there that we think is more correct. GDP is gross domestic product, but GDI is gross domestic income, and they're supposed to be equal to each other. But while GDP, real GDP, is up about 2.5 to 3% on a year-over-year basis, GDI is flat. And so there's discrepancy out there and a lot of confusion. And a lot of people also believe that real growth is associated with higher inflation. It is not. The history of the last 40 years is that when the economy is moving forward, that inflation tends to come down because productivity increases. So I think if I were to sum up the answer, there's been a lot of confusion around economic statistics. It hasn't surprised us that inflation has come down, but it has surprised others. And for that reason, the stock market went up last year. And our strategy went up even more than the stock market generally for the year. And many people are surprised by that too, because we have moved away from the Magnificent Seven, except for Tesla. And many people are now beginning to drop Tesla from Magnificent, and they're saying Magnificent Six. We don't own much of the Magnificent Six, and yet we did much better than the market. And that's beginning to suggest to us that when it comes to innovation, the market is beginning to broaden out in terms of what is performing well. And that's a healthy signal when it comes to innovation. However, what is unhealthy in many people's minds is that the broader-based market, in terms of the broad-based indices, has narrowed to the Magnificent Six. Again, lots of confusion, lots of debate out there, but that's what makes a market. And we're pretty excited about where we stand when it comes to truly disruptive innovation.
You will get a chance to develop that in a bit. But before we do that, I'm just going to say that to celebrate the fund and that it's been with us for more than a year now, we're actually going to reduce the fund fee from 0.94% yearly to 0.77% yearly. So that's an offer for all of our listeners that are interested in the fund. But Kathy, of course, we're very interested in you and your strategy, especially when it comes to technology and, of course, disruptive innovation. We're talking about it on, and we can't talk about disruptive innovation without mentioning early adopters. So I'm yes. actually curious about the early adopter theme. So I'm just going to ask you right out, what is your view on being an early adopter? And is it something that you should always aim for? Is that the key to disruptive innovation or to be successful?
Well, it is. It certainly is. I'll give you a good example of this. When we launched ARK Invest, which was 10 years ago, we just celebrated our 10th year anniversary. One of our biggest holdings was NVIDIA. And NVIDIA back then was considered just a PC gaming chip company. That's all it was. It just wasn't a big deal. But we saw that it was going to be key to autonomous transportation. GPUs were going to be key. And even more broadly, it was going to be key to artificial intelligence. And so we loaded up when it was $5. Today, it is over $700. And what you're seeing is a lot of institutions piling in after we've enjoyed this ride from five to many portfolios still hold it. The flagship does not anymore because we're on to the next big beneficiary of artificial intelligence, and that is software companies. And so one of the newest names we've put in is Palantir. Palantir's CEO, Alex Karp, believes that it will be the largest software company in the world. Now, that's really saying something when Microsoft and others are in the $1.5 to $2 trillion range. Palantir is only around $50 billion. But we believe it could be possible that Palantir will be the biggest beneficiary long-term of artificial intelligence. Many people are using Microsoft as their pick. We are using Palantir. And you'll see others like UiPath are in the portfolio because they're using the large language models, both open source and private, to build their more specialized models and develop products for robotic process automation. So we like to pick stocks that many people do not know. The ones that you know so well, the Magnificent Six, of course they're going to benefit from artificial intelligence. And most people know that. But many people may be surprised that we are concerned about Alphabet, because ChatGPT is a real challenge to the search business. Instead of searching on Google, you go to ChatGPT and go directly to websites that you're, and the same is true when it comes to shopping. Instead of going through Amazon, you might go through ChatGPT and find, you know, the cheapest jacket and the fastest delivery for free directly from the website of the company. So we think even the Magnificent Seven could be disrupted here. So we're moving away from most of them.
But don't you think that companies such as Alphabet has the possibility to adjust for that and make adjustments in their strategy?
We often say that ChatGPT is either the best thing or the worst thing that's happened to Google. Finally, Google, I mean, I don't know about you, but I have always disliked searching on Google, especially for research. It just does not understand what I'm trying to find.
But ChatGPT does.
And ChatGPT does. So I am much more inclined to go to ChatGPT these days to search than I am to Google. And, you know, that is a problem for Google because 95% of Google's revenues are from advertising associated with search. So we shall see. When I say it's the best thing that could have happened to Google, finally, it has lit a fire under that management team. And they have combined the two AI research efforts that they had competing against each other, effectively DeepMind, which is the most important, it's a UK company, most important AI company in the world, housed inside of Google. Finally, they're giving them more power to go for it. I don't know if it'll be soon enough. And I know there's going to be a lot more competition than there is today in search.
But competition is always good for companies. Sometimes they need...
For consumers.
But I'm really interested in what you said, because you said that you were early on in NVIDIA and now you don't own it anymore. Is that a part of your strategy to use it while it has this kind of rocket growth and then you get rid of it and take something else to be able to do these early adopting?
Yes. We're very focused on the undiscovered, and everyone's discovered the Magnificent Seven. NVIDIA is the check-the-box AI company. If you own it, and most of your investors, if they're involved with other portfolios, they will own NVIDIA. It's a check-the-box stock. We are using our research to say, okay, where's the next big wave? And we think it's in software. And we think the expectation levels in NVIDIA are becoming so high that it will have an inventory correction at some point. Whenever I hear the word shortage, as we have with GPUs for the last year, whenever I hear the word shortage, I know there's going to be double ordering, triple ordering, quadruple ordering, and at some point too much inventories as companies begin to assess, wait a minute, We can't let all of these divisions do different things, use different tools around AI. We need to have some strategic objective and plan here when it comes to artificial intelligence. So we think there'll be a pause out there as companies try and figure out the best way forward when it comes to artificial intelligence, because it's so important. It's such an important strategic plan that companies need to formulate, so because it's going to separate the winners from the losers.
That's very interesting. Thank you for that. But I also have to ask you, have you ever been an early adopter but failed? Have you made any mistakes with it?
Sure. And I learned a lot of lessons at my last company. We had assumed that satellite radio would proliferate around the world faster than it ultimately did. It became much more niche. Now, what was our mistake back then? It was not tracking the cost declines in satellite technology and understanding that those costs were going to remain too high. And so as part of our research, we need to understand what exactly is the cost decline associated with each technology, and when will those costs drop low enough to enter emerging markets? Because that's what did not happen with satellite radio. Satellite technology just was too expensive until very recently. And now we have Starlink from SpaceX. And now we're doing a lot of research on satellite technology to understand how big the markets they're going to host are going to be. And we think there could be $84 billion in revenue from satellite technology enabling broadband, not only to emerging markets, but on the ocean for RVs, recreation vehicles, for airplanes. I just learned that Hawaiian Air has just launched Starlink on its planes, and Wi-Fi is beautiful, just like on Earth. So we are ready now for prime time. But back in the early 2000s, we weren't. And so that when I started ARC with our chief futurist, who came also had been at my previous firm, my primary task for him was to focus on cost declines, price elasticity of demand, and just make sure we're ready for prime time with all of these new technologies.
It's really interesting to hear that you actually made a try on satellites, and now it's coming back.
Yes,
then you
absolutely.
Then it's not a failure, I would say. but we're gonna move on, because you just launched, or you have this big ideas that you write every year, and you had one coming from this year just a few weeks ago. The big ideas for 2024. Can you please give us an overview of this? I know there's five different categories, and we would love to hear more about them.
Sure. Well, the first thing that I'll say is we spend a lot of time in this big ideas focusing on the convergence among the five platforms and 14 different technologies.
And, can you explain that a little more in detail? What does convergence mean in this case?
Sure. It means that these technologies are enabling one another and speeding the rate of change up. And artificial intelligence is the biggest catalyst. It is the reason that the other technologies, the other platforms that I mentioned, are going to grow at a faster rate than they otherwise would.
Due to the AI.
So I'll give you an example. Okay. Autonomous transportation, robo-taxis, so autonomous taxi networks is another way of saying them. That's the convergence among three of the major platforms. It's highly unusual to have three major platforms converging at the same time. So autonomous vehicles are robots. They will be electric, so that's energy storage. And they'll be powered by artificial intelligence. So each one of those platforms alone is following its own S-curve. An S-curve starts out slowly when it comes to innovation in terms of growth, and then it hits a hockey stick, prime time. And what we have with these three technologies and autonomous transportation is one S-curve feeding another S-curve, feeding another S-curve, causing not just exponential growth, rapid growth for an extended period of time, but super exponential growth, rapid growth that is accelerating. Now, many people say, well, that technology is failing. Look at Cruise Automation, which it was GM's autonomous effort. They're shutting it down because of an accident San Francisco. And so many people think that Tesla and others will not be able to pull autonomous transportation off. Well, right now there are 20 autonomous transportation efforts around the world, many of them in China, and seven of them are commercial. Companies are making money from them. So it's possible. It's possible. Tesla is the sleeper here. And we believe that it is going to be the winner in the United States because it is the only company that has developed its own chip, AI chip, specific to autonomous transportation. And we think that this is an $8 to $10 trillion revenue opportunity for the entire ecosystem. And the platforms, which we think Tesla will be an autonomous taxi platform, will get up to half of that. So $4 to $5 trillion in revenue around the world. So we think it's a very big idea and it's going to transform our lives. We won't have to own cars anymore. We won't have to pay upfront for transportation, or we won't have to lease transportation. We can just pay as we go in autonomous vehicles. And the cost is going to come down dramatically.
But will you say that Tesla, because now you're mentioning Tesla, would you say that Tesla is an electrical vehicle company or an AI company?
It is so many technology companies rolled up in one. It is a battery company. It is a robotics company, including now Optimus, its humanoid robot for manufacturing cars, its plants. It is an artificial intelligence company. It's the only company in the transportation space to have a special purpose chip to power its cars. And so it is also a software as a service company with over-the-air software updates that fix cars before owners even know anything's going wrong with them. I have had my Model 3 since 2018, so that's 6 years now, almost 6 years, and I've never had to take it in for maintenance. Because the Tesla diagnostic system catches problems before I do and fixes them over the
air.
Like
a computer, so it updates itself.
Yes, it's like Apple doing over-the-air software updates and improving the phone. Tesla is improving the car. I have a better car today than I did when I bought it in 2018. The only time I've ever had to take it in had nothing to do with the electric vehicle. It had to do with a nail in the tire. And of course, software can't update that. I had to take that in.
I understand that. But I'm just going to go back to this because you say that AI is the most important one of these and that they kind of merge together all the platforms that you're talking about.
Yes.
I'm also just going to mention to the listeners that if you're interested in reading more in detail about these different platforms, that it's available on your website, right?
Yes, arc-invest.com. Absolutely.
I will also put a link in the description, so it's easy for the listeners to find it. But I just have to ask you, because in Sweden, of course, we like innovation and being early adopters, but there are anyways many people who are afraid of AI. Would you say that there are any dangers, and should people be afraid?
Well, we know that all technologies can be used for nefarious purposes, and artificial intelligence is no exception. What I am happy to see is so many people worried about it. Half of the solution is understanding the problem. So I think Elon Musk and others who have warned us about what can go wrong with AI are doing us and the technology community a great favor, because what do we have also evolving here is we're having cybersecurity built around artificial intelligence and a huge neighborhood watch. That's why we're in favor of open source AI models. It's because like other open source models, when you have so many developers relying on an open source ecosystem, they are watching out for the health of it as well. So we're very much in favor of the open source models like Meta Platforms, Llama 2, and other open source models. I think we're going to see Llama 3 pretty soon. GPT-4 may be the best model out there right now. Let's see what Llama 3 has to offer. And Llama 3 is open source.
So it could both be our enemy and our savior?
I think it's going to be one of the biggest productivity enhancers in history. We think that knowledge worker productivity will increase 4 to 10-fold by 2030. And what that means is the same person can do a lot more work and be paid more without causing overall inflation to increase. Output per man hour increases. That's productivity. So it's a win-win for companies and people.
Yeah, we're very excited to see more about AI in the next coming years. It's only been one year with ChatGPT, and it's already revolutionized a lot here. But let's move on to Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. I have a question here, and it is, do you think that Bitcoin eventually will be something that you actually pay with, or do you think that it has evolved to be something that is more of an investment?
Yes. So our very first paper on Bitcoin, and it's still on our site, was in 2015, when Bitcoin was only $250. Today it's $47,000. We asked the question, can Bitcoin or could Bitcoin serve the three roles of money? So means of exchange, which is what you're talking about, Felicia. Mm-hmm. Store of value, which is how people are using it right now. They're buying it and holding it like gold, digital gold. And unit of account. Do we think prices will be in Bitcoin terms? And if you go back to that paper, technically the answer to that question is yes, all three roles. Right now, especially in the developed world, it's being used as a store of value. If you go to emerging markets, and we have on our website something called Bitcoin Brainstorm, I think the second episode of that was the convergence between Bitcoin and artificial intelligence. And what you see coming out of that convergence is more in the emerging markets, Bitcoin being used as a means of exchange using the Lightning Network. So it's already happening. In fact, the gig economy is we think the convergence between Bitcoin and AI is going to put the gig economy on steroids. It's already happening. Micro jobs in emerging markets. So if you're interested in learning more about how it is being used as a means of exchange, you're welcome to listen to that podcast.
I would love to do that to learn more about it. I'm actually curious about I'm kind of switching subjects now.
Okay.
You know, the time kind of just passes by. So I'm curious about your perception on Sweden, because Sweden is kind of a small country, but mm-hmm. as a Swede, our perception is that we're very innovative and developed and kind of like putting so many innovations out there. But what is your, or what is the American perception on Sweden?
Yeah, I can tell you what my perception is, and I formed it very early on in my career. So in the 80s and 90s, I remember when it came to cellular infrastructure, Ericsson was it.
Yeah.
Ericsson was it. And I remember it was a model for American companies to spend a huge amount on R&D. I admired that Ericsson was willing to forego short-term profits to invest aggressively into R&D. And it really became a leader in the wireless infrastructure space. I know that China has come in with Huawei and been a bit disruptive, but we saw Sweden do the right thing there. We own Spotify, not in the flagship fund, in some of our more specialized funds. And we see, what we admire is the two-sided marketplace for consumers to listen to music and musicians to have a platform on which to play, distribute their music. And so we love what Spotify is doing with AI assistance, helping consumers find the next big musician out there, and create this two-sided marketplace for both music and podcasts. So very much there. In the fintech space, Sweden has been very progressive. We know Klarna is Swedish. I will say, because of the scarcity of stocks in the innovative space in Europe broadly, sometimes stocks get bid up way too much, and Klarna was a big example of that in the buy now, pay later space. It was very creative, very fast moving, kind of a first mover, and was such a rarity in Europe that it was bid up to crazy, crazy levels. So we never participated in it, especially because we had Block with Square's Cash App and Afterpay as a competitor. So yes, the DNA in Sweden, very strong for disruptive innovation.
Do you know any more companies in Sweden that you know of or heard of? I'm just curious here.
Yeah. There are a few in the 3D printing space, and we have, I'm pulling them up now, we have a few, our company, so the 3D printing space is a self-indexed fund for us. We have self-indexed ourselves, the strategy, and I can't find it now, but there are a few, Hexagon, I think, is one of them. There are a few companies in that portfolio that are Swedish. So 3D printing is another area.
It's just very, as a Swede, you know, when you talk to such a huge fund manager that you actually know the companies. So I think everyone will be delighted to hear that. But we're going to move on. I'm very curious about your view on the future, because disruptive innovation is very focused on the future. So I'm just going to give you this task now. If you imagine a regular day in, let's say, 2060, what do you think a regular day would look like? Where will we work? How will we live? How will we transport ourselves?
Yes, well, I think one of the very surprising trends that will evolve, that when I say this, people just don't expect it or understand it. If you look at the average workday, it has gone down over the last century. And it had its biggest drop in the earlier 1900s, I'd say the first half of that century, because we were coming off the farm and into industry, and there was a lot of labor all day, you know, hours and hours on the farm, which actually went down as we went into the factory. And we believe that now that we're entering more and more of the digital world and the physical world are coming together, they're converging. We're going to see another drop off in the number of days spent at work. You'll see that in big ideas. So you'll work fewer hours per day, and you'll be more flexible. We can imagine taking a business trip and being in the office all day in a car, an autonomous car, driving from, you know, one part of Europe to another part of Europe, and, you know, going to a meeting. And while you're in the meeting, sending the car out and letting other people ride in it so that you can have funds to pay down, or your company can have funds to pay down the cost of the vehicle. So we'll have more free time. We'll be more flexible. We think that in terms of disruption, the industries that will be completely transformed will be the transportation industry. It'll be autonomous, whether we're talking about on the ground or in the air, autonomous taxis, and drones that deliver food and groceries to us. We're probably not going to need very big pantries anymore, because instead of going in the U.S. at least, I know in Europe it's a little different, but you know, most families go to the grocery store once a week and they make a big purchase then, and they have big pantries. But with drones, we think we're going to have deliveries 5, 6, 10, 20 times a day, because it's going to be so inexpensive. So we'll just buy as we go, and we won't need to store as much. That's another big change. We think that in the financial services sector, blockchain technology will transform it completely. We'll take a lot of the middlemen out. So that tax that we pay when we use credit cards, anywhere from 1.5% to 4% tax, that is going to shrink to maybe 0.5%. So the cost of financial service, and a lot of banks will go out of business, especially bank branches. We won't need them. We'll be carrying a bank in our pocket.
Are you saying that Avanza won't survive?
No, you're digital. Yeah,
We are the
No, you're in the digital world. You're part of this movement.
We are the bank in the pocket.
There you are, the bank in the pocket. So and we think that is going to be the place that to compete for the pocket. In medicine, healthcare, the convergence among sequencing technologies, so DNA, RNA, proteins, methylation, epigenetics, those sequencing technologies converging with artificial intelligence, converging with CRISPR gene editing, is going to cure disease. We've had the first FDA and European approval of CRISPR gene editing for beta thalassemia and sickle cell disease in the last few months. This is curing sickle cell disease, curing beta thalassemia. And just to give you a sense of how profound this is.
And I know that you can read about this in the Big Ideas as well, just if anyone is interested.
Yes, the first man in the beta thalassemia trial that CRISPR Therapeutics hosted, that was nearly 4 years ago. He used to go into the hospital on an emergency basis 17 times per year for a blood transfusion. Since that first edit, only one therapy, he's not had to go in at all. Think about that. That's almost 4 years. How profound a change, curing disease or diagnosing cancer in stage one, or maybe even before stage one, as the body is setting up and AI begins to understand, what does a body setting up for cancer look like and come in and prevent it? So, you know, our lives are probably going to extend, and we will not die from cancer. We'll die from something else that AI and other therapies will also be trying to cure.
Yeah, we can hope that that the innovation will give us more health and healthcare and healthier lives. But yes, we're going to move on again. Sorry, Kathy.
Yes.
I have a bonus question for you that I know that a lot of our female listeners are interested in. We think that it's very important with equality and more equality in the investment world. And you are a female fund manager, a very successful fund manager, and a role model to many. May I ask what you think must be done so that we could see more female fund managers and more females in the finance industry?
Yes, what I think one of the things that ARC has done has we identified an unmet need in the investment world. And I believe that was disruptive innovation. There was no pure play company focused on disruptive innovation. And we had done enough research to say, this is going to be big. We're ready for prime time. Let's start a company and let's put this portfolio in a wrapper that is what consumers want, the ETF structure here in the United States. And that became a winning combination. So I think my advice is identify an unmet need and see if you can go fill it, because then you can bring a lot of other people who have the same vision or want to be a part of the vision along. And if you look at our company, our team page, you'll see a huge amount of diversity, because I don't believe that traditional thinkers in the financial space or any space for that matter are going to be the disruptors in the future. And, you know, if you're disruptive, what does that mean? Well, most people think what you're doing is ridiculous. They don't agree with it and they fight. They fight you on it. They debate. And that always makes me feel good. Wait a minute. We might be onto something big because no one thinks it's right. And, you know, when everyone's moving in one direction and you have an idea that takes you in a different direction and not many people have that idea, then you might be onto something big and you can bring a lot of other people along with you.
Swim against the stream.
Yes.
I actually, you said that criticism, I just have to ask you, sometimes, I mean, you have a large fan base, but some people don't agree with you. What do you mostly get criticized about?
Yes, the biggest criticism is that we are index agnostic. I think the traditional financial world believes that we need to be investing in line with some benchmark or to beat some benchmark. When we say we're index agnostic, we believe we will beat over time, over the long term, we will beat all those benchmarks if we're right on how the world's changing and how early we are in understanding who the winners are going to be. I mentioned NVIDIA. I'm mentioning Palantir now. But that's the biggest criticism, and yet we will throw the criticism back and say, wait a minute, the companies in these benchmarks, especially those are at the top, are there because of past performance, you know, amazing success in the past. And we talked about Google earlier. Well, what if disruptive innovation is disrupting the traditional world order, then what we say is maybe using a benchmark as your guide is not such a great idea. Or if you are using a benchmark as your guide, then use our strategy to be a hedge against the disruption in your portfolios. So we try to turn lemons into lemonade, that take their criticism and say, hey, okay, if we're right, maybe you're sitting on some value traps and you should use ARK as a hedge against those value traps. And that seems to be working in large part.
Well, I guess time will have to tell who's right and not. But I'm very, very thankful that we got to hear you out today, Kathy. I would love to sit here for several more hours, but I'm gonna have to let you go now. So thank you very, very much. And I hope that we will have a third guest appearance sometime soon.
Thank you, Felicia. My pleasure entirely. And go Avanza.
Have a good day and go ARK Invest.
All right. Thank you.